Welcome to the Cello Sherpa podcast, where we explore all aspects of the climb to the summit from intermediate musician to the professional stage. Check us out online at thecellosherpa.com or follow us on Instagram, TikTok, or YouTube at The Cello Sherpa. I'm Joel Dallow, your host. I joined the cello section of the Atlanta Symphony Orchestra in 1999 and founded the Riverside Chamber Players based in Roswell, Georgia in 2003. If you're looking for a bit of extra help on learning your orchestra or solo repertoire, perhaps we can help. Visit www.thecellosherpa.com and drop us a line. We offer virtual or in-person lessons. Amazingly, thanks to you all for continuing to listen to this podcast, we are closing in on our 100th episode. For that special episode, our very first guest, Stephen Isserlis, will be joining us again to celebrate this milestone. So we're going to try something different with Stephen this time and ask him questions submitted by all of you. If you have something you would like to ask Stephen Isserlis, then please visit www.thecellosherpa.com. Click on the contact link and submit your questions there. Today's episode is sponsored by Clear Resources, your premier resource for compliance, legal, ethics, and risk. For more information, visit them online at clearresources.com. Today's guest is cellist Zlatimir Fung. Zlatimir first joined us last May, and we talked about his experience as the youngest cellist to ever win the Tchaikovsky competition. Starting this fall, he will be the youngest faculty member to ever join the Juilliard School. Welcome back to the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thanks so much. I'm happy to be back and looking forward to speaking again.
So what have you been up to since the last time we spoke?
Yeah, so I guess it's been about a year since we spoke last, and it's been an interesting year, a lot of playing. This season, one of the highlights for me is that I'm artist in residence with the Royal Philharmonic Orchestra. So I'll be with them in the UK for three different periods this season, playing three different concertos. So that's exciting. And a few months ago, I just finished recording my first album. It won't be released until early 2025, but that was a big personal accomplishment for me.
So let's talk a little bit about that residency then. What concertos are you going to play with them?
Sure. So back in September, I played the Elgar, and I actually just finished doing sort of a mini tour, five concerts in the UK with the Haydn C. And then our last period in May of this year will be the Saint-Saëns Concerto No. 1.
Oh, cool. So is this something that they typically do, or was this a new thing for you?
I believe that they have a different artist in residence every season. So I'm very lucky and grateful to be in that position for this particular season.
Yeah, that's a really cool idea. And then your album's going to come out in 2025. So we have quite a while to anticipate that. Can you share with us some of the things you recorded for that?
Yeah, absolutely. So the concept for the album is that it's all opera fantasias and arrangements. So I played a couple of more standard 19th century fantasies. There's one that I did by Servais on La Fille du Régiment. Then I also commissioned a friend of mine to do a new Carmen fantasy, which I'm very excited about sharing with everyone. And a couple others. And I also did one of my own fantasies on Janáček's Janufa.
Oh, so you arranged it yourself?
Yeah.
Is that something you've done a lot of?
Actually, it was my first time trying it, and it was quite a long process. Actually, from conception to completion, it was almost a year. So I was studying the opera a lot and trying to listen to it and just get the music in my blood. And that already took several months. And then the actual assembly of like deciding which sections of the opera I wanted to feature in the fantasy and how they would be arranged in a way that felt kind of natural and not too random was yet another challenge. So it was really rewarding, and I look forward to sharing it with everyone.
Awesome. So how did this Juilliard appointment come about?
Yeah, so I'm joining faculty in the fall this year, and it was kind of a process that evolved over time. But basically, one of my former teachers, Richard Aaron, who for a long time held this dual appointment at the University of Michigan and Juilliard, he's actually leaving Juilliard and going to the San Francisco Conservatory.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So he had quite a long standing relationship with Juilliard, and he felt that it was a lot of travel back and forth for him. So I think he's sort of rearranging where he's going to live and everything as it pertains to his new position in San Francisco. So it turned out then that the school had this open search to fill his position. And, you know, because I'm quite close with him, I studied with him for 8 years.
Okay.
So I talk with him quite often and he was encouraging me. He was like, oh, you should go for it. I think it would be an interesting thing for you to try out. So I did, and I applied through the open search, and yeah, that's how it came about.
Can you talk a little bit about that application process? What was involved in that and what that was like?
Sure. So it was actually interesting for me because I'd never done an interview. I'd never done something like that. It was a moment for me to seek advice from my parents because they'd both done a lot of interviews. My father is a software engineer. So he was like, oh yeah, you know, I've done a lot of interviews. I've also been on the other side. I can tell you what they're going to ask.
Yeah.
So I was doing a bunch of prep. I had, you know, obviously the first step was like to send in a resume and everything and a cover letter. And then when the time came for the first interview, I like did a couple mock interviews and I was like, okay, I'm feeling good. I know what they're going to ask. And then they asked literally nothing that I prepared. It was like all super out of the box stuff. But it was fun because they were asking questions that kind of, they provoke you in a good way. It's like, oh, I hadn't thought about that, but that's actually a good question to ask someone, you know, if they're a prospective candidate for this position. So yeah, so there was that. And then there were a couple more rounds of interviews with different people involved in the search committee. And then the final step was that I actually came into the school and gave a couple of trial lessons, which were recorded for the committee to view afterward.
So how much teaching experience have you had leading up to this point where you were comfortable giving trial lessons?
So I started my very first private student. I took on sort of at the beginning of the pandemic in like April 2020.
Okay.
Before that, I'd given a couple of master classes because people had asked me, especially after the Tchaikovsky competition, if I went to play somewhere, they'd say, oh, can you gear a couple of cellists here?
Yeah.
So I was a little bit familiar, but I didn't feel like I had teaching chops, quote unquote, if,
right.
if you know what I mean. And during the pandemic, you know, there's a lot of free time. So I was also doing a little bit of teaching at like, there was a program, the Virtual Cello Summer Festival, I believe that's what it was called. And so I was seeing some students and it was really interesting, a great learning experience for me to work with students of different backgrounds, different levels, and see how I could be of help to them, regardless of what they were playing or where they were
yeah.
in their development. And then, you know, since then, I've basically since that point, I've had a private studio for the past 4 years almost. And yeah, it's been a source of great learning for me and yeah, great joy, of course. But yeah, so that's sort of my background.
So was Juilliard something that you always had on your mind or did you not even really think about it until Richard Aaron had suggested it?
Yeah, it hadn't really been something I'd thought about a lot because it's the kind of thing where you don't really consider it until the possibility presents itself. You know, it's like, he's leaving and now suddenly there's an opening. But, you know, these kinds of openings are kind of rare because, well, for a number of reasons, I think the primary one is that it's professors stay at schools for a long time so that they can really take care of the students that they accept. You know, it's a big thing yeah. to leave a school after a few years because as opposed to, you know, other disciplines, like my mother's in the math world and she was telling me like, oh, yeah, you can take a job and leave after a year. And I was like, I don't think it works that way. And, you know, if you're taking a first year undergrad, you really want to see them through to the completion of their degree.
Yeah.
The relationship
so true.
Is very, very intimate. Yeah. So. But yeah. So
they don't come up very often. So it wasn't really on your radar, I guess, until he pointed that out. Huh?
Yeah, exactly. And I think I didn't really have any expectations of like, you know, knowing that I would be the right fit for the school or whatnot, but it was something that I was interested in. So I went for it.
Yeah, that's great. Did you have to put together a CV, curriculum vitae for that?
I did. I don't think I put together such a great one. It was sort of just like, here are the recitals I've played, here are the orchestras I've played with, here's my teaching experience, you know, just like pretty basic.
Yeah. I've always looked at that compared to the resume and thought, ooh, it's very daunting.
Right.
So what will your teaching load be? How many students will you have?
So I'll be starting with a teaching load of maximum 4 students.
Okay.
Which is something that I feel is like a load that I can wrap my head around. I was a little worried about overcommitting myself, you know, not only for my sake, but also because I really feel like that relationship is so important between the teacher and the student, especially if someone's an undergraduate. So I really would want to be there for everyone in the fullest way possible. So it's a 4 maximum, but things are still sort of being sorted out with the auditions for this year. So
yeah.
I don't know exactly what it will end up being, but something around that.
And will you have other responsibilities? Will you do a rep class or weekly studio class or anything like that?
I'm not sure about that. I mean, I think that officially, the only responsibilities are the teaching, the auditions, and the juries at the end of the year. But I personally love studio class. I'm actually quite big on like the European model where there's no such thing as a private lesson. You know, it's like everyone can always observe someone else's lesson. So yeah, studio class is something that I'll definitely be doing, perhaps over Zoom, but I think it's still really valuable.
Yeah. Do you have some idea on how you will balance your performing career with your student load?
Yeah. I mean, I think my idea right now is that, you know, whenever I'm back home in New York, I'll just be, you know, seeing my students as often as possible. Like if I'm back for 4 days, then maybe I'll see them on the first day and then on the fourth day so that there's still enough of a gap between our sessions. But yeah, I'm definitely keeping this new responsibility in mind as I'm constructing what I'm doing during the season, performing wise.
Yeah. How do you think that might change your performance focus? Will it stay exactly the same, or do you think that you will be making some sort of adjustments?
Oh, it's hard to say. I mean, I think that maybe if there's one adjustment to be made, it would be that the concerts that I play are things that I really want to do rather than things that, you know, maybe it's just occasionally you just have a week off and something comes in and you're like, oh, you know, I'm not doing anything else. Mm-hmm. You can just accept it. But, you know, maybe if it's not actually of such great artistic interest, now I can be a little more selective about it.
Yeah.
That's the hope.
Now, is Juilliard a school that expects you to go recruit, or because you have so much star power, people are just going to come flock to you anyway?
I don't think I have that much star power. I definitely have recruitment on my mind. And I feel like, you know, part of my recruitment is actually my performing, especially when I get the opportunity to perform in different cities. Like, let's say I'm giving a concert in Chicago. So many great talents there, you know, high school talents that might come to the concert and I get the chance to meet them. And
yeah,
you never know what can come out of that. And I am hoping that a week or two here or there in the summer at different festivals is something that, you know, I can arrange in the future. Mm-hmm. So that people who are not at Juilliard have the opportunity to work with me a little bit.
Are you teaching at any festivals in the summer?
This summer, I'm not. A couple of things are in the works for next summer.
Okay. You probably can't talk about that yet. Right? So what is it about teaching that you're drawn to?
Yeah, I think that, well, for me, actually, the relationship between teaching and practicing or self-improvement, if you whatever you want to call it, it's a very close relationship. And my general philosophy with any student that I hear is that I try to relate to them in the time we have together as if I were basically coaching them on how to practice like more efficiently. Mm-hmm. And how to think about the time that they have with their instrument alone. I've said it so much, but the big thing for me, like mathematically, is, you know, if you think about the fact that a student practices 4 hours a day and I'm seeing them once a week, then that means that I'm only seeing them like one out of every 28 hours that they're spending with the cello. Those other 27, it's so much more important than the time. So I basically want to equip them with, so any questions they have, you know, any concerns they have, like I want to just be a resource for them. And I feel in that sense that it really relates to the way that I am constantly practicing and working on, you know, my own playing and my own relationship to the repertoire, because I'm always questioning whether the way I'm practicing is the best way, or, you know, not necessarily the best, but whether there are other ways to approach a particular issue, new ways of looking at pieces that I've played a lot before, or new ways of learning a piece that I've never looked at before. So all these things, I feel like there's a really close relationship.
And so how do you encourage your students to seek out those answers to those questions when they're on their own versus being in that 1 hour lesson? Because I sort of say the same thing. I tell my students that my job is to teach you so that I don't have a job anymore.
Right.
Basically teach myself out of being your teacher so that right. You can learn how to teach yourself when you're home. But I'm wondering, what sort of resources do you suggest people use to get those kinds of answers?
Yeah. Well, I think for me, it fundamentally comes down to curiosity and awareness of one's playing. And this is also something that I keep in mind, you know, when I'm thinking about prospective students, mm-hmm. is I really want to see a sense that the student is not only serious about the undertaking of really trying to get better, but they also have, even if the level is not there necessarily, that they have a sense of curiosity, a sense of like knowing that there's more. And that can take many, many shapes. That's very abstract, of course. But, you know, for me, in a concrete sense, I think that has a lot to do with always seeking out music, like actually loving to listen to music, loving to listen to other players and seeing, just being curious about what they're doing. And also in a practicing capacity, like really being willing to record yourself and also being willing to be very, very tough on yourself, like just acknowledging like this isn't in tune enough, or that's not a clean shift. That's not a smooth bow change. You know, that's not doing justice to what the music demands at this particular moment. So I hope that, yeah, that answers what you were asking.
Yeah. So I guess let me explore that a little bit more, because I definitely encourage my students to listen to lots of different recordings. Matter of fact, I have several students that come in often and say, well, in this spot, this is what Vladimir Fung does. So I'm wondering what you think of that. So, and I'm not lying. That's actually a true statement.
Well, the first thing I'd say to that is, oops, I'm sorry, I'm a bad influence.
No, not at all.
Inadvertent.
No, I think it's really great because this technology is so much more advanced than when I was your age, for example. And now we have all of these things at our fingertips that we can use. And I feel like until a student, and this is what I want to hear from you, is I feel like until a student really has a sense of their own musicianship, that they need to go listen to six other people do it to get a sense of all the different ways that you can do it before you can sort of come to your own ideas of how to do it. And then, of course, there must be historical references and other things that you would look at too. But talk about that process.
No, absolutely. I think I'm definitely on the same page as you. And it's maybe a discussion for another time, but something about it actually really bothers me when people say like, oh, you should never listen to recordings. And Well, first of all, I find it ironic that a lot of the people who say that have extensive discographies. But yeah, I always think in my head, like, well, if musicians are not listening to your recordings, then who is?
You know, it's a good point. Yeah.
But anyways, cynicism aside, I think that it's sort of that mindset actually fails to recognize that fundamentally music is a language of imitation. And, You know, before there was even notation, there was the concept of singing something and then singing the same thing. You know, it's like that's how you would learn. It's just like a language, like if you're trying to perfect your accent, you're not going to be able to perfect it really just by, you know, reading the books about the IPA and like trying to adjust your tongue. You need to hear the difference between what you're doing and what someone else is doing in order to bridge that gap in your accent.
Yeah.
For me, that's a huge aspect of my philosophy, like in my approach just to playing in general. It's just that there really is that element of intuitive understanding that can really only come from a lot of input. And that goes back to the question of curiosity. Just like, even if it's bad, expose yourself to it because it's input. It's like, once you achieve a certain degree of fluency in a foreign language, you can start to recognize other people's improper accents or improper grammar, you know, because Now you have that own sense, that sense on your own of like what's right and what isn't. Not to say that there's, you know, a right or wrong in music in the same way that there is in grammar, but there's that sense of like something being more effective and less effective in getting the point across. So for me, that's a big parallel.
That's really great. I think that makes a lot of sense to me. When you're learning something, like let's take the Elgar Concerto, for example, because you just played that with the Royal Philharmonic, you said, right?
Yeah.
Okay. There's a lot of conversation about the way that Jacqueline Dupre played that piece and the way that it's supposed to be played. So My question is, how did you bridge the gap between those kinds of ideas? What sort of research did you do to come to your conclusion as to how you were going to own the musicianship and the phrasing of that particular piece?
Yeah, it's a great question. You know, I think every piece, and especially the Elgar, there's like a different continuum of complexity when it comes to the relationship between the composer's intention and the way that performers effectively play it. And I think this might be paradoxical based on what I said before, but I do think that there is an inherent knowledge that performers have that in many cases exceeds that of the composer. I would be one of the first to defend Dupre in whatever, you know, deviation she takes from the score. Because for me, the real acknowledgement is whether it works emotionally. Let's say you disagree with the tempo she takes in the coda, right? Which is like slower than the metronome marking. But you're kind of drawn in emotionally by how she's caring about every note, right? So maybe it's just that the composer didn't consider that, you know, there was this other way of doing it where you bring out this other emotion, and it's impossible to know really what he would have thought because their eras were different. It just in a general sense, I really feel that there's a quality, like I think if you are an experienced performer and you always respect, of course, you have to come from a place of respect for the music and trying to understand what the composer was going for, then you can actually assert your own knowledge In the way that you're playing the piece. Because I think ultimately, you know, it comes back down to the question. There's some musicians, I think, I won't name names, but who treat the score as like the word of God, you know. But I think that that's kind of fundamentally flawed, because ultimately the music is not the score. It's the score is an imperfect representation of the idea that the composer had. And they were working within a notational language that they knew and that other people could understand that would get them close. Mm-hmm. But there are all these things, and that's sort of the je ne sais quoi of what makes a performance great versus just kind of ordinary. It's all those things that a performer can perceive using the score as a clue, rather than using the score as this unchangeable, immovable text that they have to like very closely adhere to.
That's a really good way to explain that. It sort of makes me think a little bit about looking at a piece of Jackson Pollock art. Nobody was throwing paint on a canvas before him. And lots of people would say, well, that's not technique, but is it powerful? Does it convey something? That's what my father always said to me when we went to the MoMA. Right. And I looked at it, I said, why is that so famous? And he'd say, does it convey something? That's what matters. And I feel like you're saying exactly the same thing, but in musical terms.
Right. Yeah.
So when it comes to the audition at Juilliard, you haven't gone through them yet, right? They're coming up.
Exactly.
Do you know, when it comes to the selection process, is that done these days by a committee, or is that something that you get to decide if you want to teach a specific student?
So I think it's quite a complicated process. There are a lot of cooks in the kitchen, if you know what I mean, because there's the whole cello faculty, and we each have our individual input about every single student, which is then sort of averaged. And then there's a separate admissions committee that looks at, you know, the overall application, you know, academic excellence and whatnot. And adding to that, there's always the question of whether you as the teacher are willing to work with the student, and also whether the student wants to work with you. So for me, it's quite a complicated process. And actually, I had just had this conversation a few weeks ago with Michel Strauss, who was a professor at The Hague in the Netherlands, cello professor, and he used to be at the Paris Conservatory. And he was telling me that in the Paris Conservatory, the faculty had absolutely nothing to do with who was admitted to the school. It was a totally outside committee. And I was like, wow, that was really interesting. It's so different than the way it operates over here. Yeah. So, I mean, basically, I think there's a lot of arbitrariness. I mean, there has to be with that many people involved in making a single decision about one person's future. But, and that it should also provide some comfort to prospective students, you know, that you can't really make too much out of any particular result for any particular school, just because there's so many factors that even the people who are involved in have no control over.
Yeah. And you talked a little bit about what you're looking for in a potential student. How can you glean that from a 10-minute audition, the kinds of things that you're looking for? Because I know that's always a challenge. And we've talked about this a lot on this podcast, on how to figure out what an individual has to offer that might work with you.
It's extremely difficult. And actually, this is a conversation I had during my interviews at Juilliard, where there's the moment where we get to sort of discuss. They ask whether I have any questions for them. And well, one question I had was exactly this, like, is the 10-minute audition actually sufficient to assess a student's potential for excellence? In my opinion, it actually isn't. And if it were up to me, I would love to have a small interview component for every applicant as well. Usually talking to someone for a couple minutes, you get a sense of how serious they are. I don't mean that in the sense like how much they practice, but I mean it in the sense of like how their general approach, their humility regarding the music, how they see themselves, you know, with the craft and all those sorts of things. That's kind of what I look for. And it can sometimes be very apparent in the way that someone plays. If they play with a lot of like a great sense of care for every note, that's something quite unusual, very special. Sometimes people will play with a lot of ego, which is not necessarily like a massive red flag that means that, you know, they're not curious. But for me, it often means that there are certain layers that might need to be disarmed a little bit before you get back to that place of genuine, like, oh, this is actually why I'm here. Mm-hmm. I'm not here to, you know, just show off my vibrato or whatever. I'm here because this is actually kind of interesting. And, you know, like that, again, that sense of curiosity. So I don't mean to say this to belittle anyone, because I think that everyone has that curiosity within them, especially if they've achieved a certain level. But again, it's a matter of like those layers that sometimes attach themselves to the way people approach. And that can be a really difficult thing to disarm. You know, if you only have like, let's say 2 years together in a master's program, you know, you might spend like a year and a half trying to get back down to where you need to build up again. That can be, you know, maybe something that you don't want to go through. So maybe, yeah.
So you're 24 years old?
Yeah. Okay. Almost 25.
So you continue to break records. Obviously, as I mentioned in the beginning, the youngest faculty member to ever join Juilliard. Do you think that will have any effect on you as a faculty member there?
Well, my hope is that it won't really. I mean, it might have some influence on how, let's say, the other faculty members perceive me, but I actually feel that in a way it's kind of an asset in regard to my relationship with my students, because we're sort of that same generation. And, you know, like, I can talk to them about like TikTok trends and stuff like that, you know, and it's like, I feel like there's just a different kind of ethos with that. And it's like, I want my students to see me as friends, at least at this stage in my teaching life. You know, I say that because I've learned so much from my peers. Like, there's certain people, like, you know, younger than me that, like, you know, I see them and like instantly it's like, wow, you know, like I have something to learn from that. I always remember this. There's this wonderful saying with Confucius that Confucius said. Basically, he said something like, if it's you and two other people in a room, like if it's three people, one of them is a teacher for you. You can learn something from them. And I always just think about, everyone has something to teach you. So I've learned so much from my peers. I feel like that relationship of learning doesn't necessarily have to have this massive power disparity as it has, you know, traditionally, especially in our field.
So given your age, how will people address you?
Oh, first name, for sure.
Okay.
I cringe.
I think I did that till I was like 35, and then I was like, okay, I'm old enough now. It did change somewhere. I can't exactly remember where, but it did. So you studied with Richard Aaron for 8 years. Would you say he's one of your biggest teaching influences?
Absolutely. I would say, going back to the idea of like imitation, as teachers, we sort of end up mimicking certain things, like the way that we were taught. So even just something as simple as like the structure of a lesson, that's always a question. Like, do you have them play through at the beginning? Do you have them ask questions first? Like, there's so many different ways you can approach it. But I feel like I just do whatever I did when I was in, you know, in my life. Like, I would usually play and then we'd talk.
Yeah.
So that's the way. And I feel like that's useful for the students in general. Of course, I ask them if they want to do something different. Yeah, you know, and in terms of teaching influence, like, naturally, our teachers are huge influences on our teaching, because our teachers are huge influences on our practicing, and our practicing influences our teaching. Like, so the way that we think about solving problems, the way we think about finding good fingerings and bowings and approaching a score structurally, all those things, you know, I learned so much from my teachers about that.
Yeah.
And so that's sort of the way that I convey information also to students.
Is there anything else we might have missed that you want to share with our audience?
I don't think so. I mean, it's obviously a huge honor for me to be in this position. You know, I take the responsibility very seriously. And the one thing I will share is that the thing that excites me most about this new chapter in my life is the prospect of having a student or students who are so great that they surpass me and I can learn a lot from them.
Mm-hmm.
That just is so exciting to me. And it would be like my honor to be a small part in like another, like a truly great cellist development.
Yeah.
To add something small to that.
That's really special. Well, thank you so much for joining us today on the Cello Sherpa podcast.
Thank you for having me. Always a pleasure to speak.
Thank you so much to Zlatimir Fung for joining us today and sharing his story with us. And thank you for listening to another episode of the Cello Sherpa podcast. For more information on Zlatimir and any of the links we spoke about today, check out our show notes by scrolling down on the episode. Be sure and catch our next episode, where we interview pianist and radio host Christopher O'Reilly. We talk about the incredible success he had as the host of the National Public Radio program From the Top for 23 years. We're here to serve you, so if you have questions or topic suggestions you would like us to cover in future episodes, please use the contact page on our website, thecelloSherpa.com. You will also find information about the specific services we offer on the website. Don't forget to follow us and rate us on whatever platform you get your podcasts. This helps us climb the rankings so other people can find us. Today's episode was edited by Eric Begay at Red House Productions and produced and recorded by me, Joel Dallow.